G.K. Chesterton once said, "The poets have been mysteriously silent on the subject of cheese." And that's surprising because in 2010 alone, the average American consumed 33 pounds of cheese, about three times the amount consumed 40 years earlier. Artisanal cheese making has also been growing in this country. Since so many of us eat so much cheese, we thought that we would try to learn more about it on this Food Friday, Please Explain. And we will also find out, perhaps, how to make it at home. Joining us are Sasha Anderson, Director of Education at Murray's Cheese, and Janaclis Caldwell, a cheesemaker at Folia Farm and author of Mastering Artisan Cheesemaking. It's published by Chelsea Green. We also invite our listeners to join the conversation. Give us a call at 212-433-9692 to ask a question, or you can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org, and you can catch up with us on Facebook or Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at Leonard Lopate. So welcome to our show, and let's begin with you, Janaclis. How does milk become cheese? What's the basic process?
Oh, well, the basic process is one of causing the cheese to coagulate so that the solids are able to then be separated from the liquid portion of the milk. And it's a, you know, it's a food preservation process, but it's also becoming a, simply for the delight of eating the end process. So it involves usually some culture, starter bacteria to acidify the milk, and then usually a coagulant of some sort, and then a process of separating those solids.
No, I understand. I've been mispronouncing your name. It's Janaclis.
Oh, it doesn't bother me at all.
Well, I will pronounce it Janaclis from now on. Where does the name come from?
It's Greek, and from what I'm told, it's a Greek family last name from my dad's side, and I've been told in Greece it's pronounced Janaclis, so I don't know if there is a right way to pronounce it here.
Now, you make raw milk cheeses mostly.
All of ours are raw.
What's the difference when you're using pasteurized milk?
Well, pasteurized milk starts out, if you ask me, behind the curve a little bit because you've removed all the natural bacteria in the milk, or most of it, and those give the raw milk cheese a leg up during the process, provided that the cheesemaker is doing a good job and nurturing that milk. And often I think, and this may be just a prejudice on my side, that the raw milk producer, when they know that that milk is going to be used raw, is often a bit more attentive to cleanliness and attentive to the health of the animals. So the milk may start out even more nutritious and even more flavorful than a milk that's destined for the grocery store or ubiquitous gallon jug.
And are most of your cheeses cow's milk cheeses, or do you use goat sheep?
Actually, yes. We milk a breed of goats called Nigerian dwarf goats. So they're a little breed that has a milk much more like sheep's milk. I do work with cow's milk from a local source, not for sale, but for the classes I teach and for the recipes I've worked up for the book. And I haven't had the good luck to work with any sheep's milk yet.
Now, Sasha, isn't mozzarella also made with water buffalo milk?
It is indeed, right? That's sort of the most traditional way to make mozzarella di bufala, which is wonderful because buffalo milk is actually about twice as high in butterfat as cow's milk, which makes it, of course, a really delicious cheese. And I think also probably, Janaclis, correct me if I'm wrong, but presents some interesting challenges for the cheesemaker as well.
It does. It's each milk type is definitely suited for some particular cheese is meant to showcase that milk type often. And that's one of the challenges for the cheesemaker is to never see this white liquid as the same. But to appreciate its differences and then find the cheese that it will shine in.
Sasha, regulators are often concerned about raw milk cheeses. Do you find at Murray's that people prefer them?
Well, it certainly depends. I think that as a general rule, yes, if there's a pasteurized milk cheese that's made sort of using the same process as a raw milk cheese, people will generally prefer the raw milk cheese for the reasons that the Janaclis brings up.
So why do governments get involved with all of this?
Well, it has a lot to do with food safety, and it has a lot to do with food safety sort of around the time that milk was becoming an industrialized product and was moving from the farm into the factory and had to travel long periods. So for me, pasteurization is a tool sort of in our food safety tool shed, but it's certainly not the only tool.
Are there cheeses that are made with combinations of milks?
Certainly, absolutely. Not typically a combination of raw and pasteurized, but of course a combination of a number of different kinds of milk. You can find, of the four major milk types, cow, sheep, goat, and water buffalo, a combination of almost any of those.
So it just depends on what the cheesemaker has at hand?
Absolutely. And in fact, with many of our mixed milk cheese types, for example, a cheese like La Tour, which is a soft cow, goat, and sheep's milk cheese from northern Italy, you'll find that at different points in the season, you'll use different kinds of milk because, of course, these animals are breeding at different times and therefore producing milk at different times.
I was once given a cheese tasting of Parmesan Reggiano's from the different seasons, because the cows are eating different things at different seasons, and you could really taste the difference, even though they all taste like Parmesan.
Yeah, it's amazing, right, how much of that comes from what the animal's eating and also what the cheesemaker's doing.
And I assume, Giannakoulis, that applies to the cheeses you do as well? The animals are eating different things at different times of the year?
Absolutely, and as Sasha points out, everything you do, everything that's going on around you, if you live near a forest, the molds and yeast in the air from the forest will influence it. We at our farm call what we do high-tech primitive, where we are very aware of the science and we stay in touch with the process as much as possible. Yet we allow these unknown factors from what the animals are browsing in the forest to what's in the air to influence that. And as you pointed out and Sasha said, that you with the Parmesan, that the flavor comes through, and it's almost like a vertical tasting with cheeses you can do to appreciate these seasonalities and not expect the cheese to be identical each time.
But you prefer raw milk. What about whole milk? Can good cheeses be made with less fat from 2% milk on the other hand, from cream?
It definitely depends on which cheese you're talking about. The cheese you, Parmigiano Reggiano, is made with partly skimmed milk so that the flavor of the proteins come through more during breakdown. And then the high fat of sheep's milk with that breakdown of fat allows for unique flavors for Romano and Roquefort and things that. So it just depends on the cheese and what you're going for, texture and flavor wise.
Today's Please Explain is a look at cheese, and my guests are Giannakoulis Caldwell, cheesemaker at Folia Farm. Her book is Mastering Artisan Cheesemaking. Also with us is Sasha Anderson, Director of Education at Murray's Cheese. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Sasha, Giannakoulis mentioned that cheese making requires a coagulant and a culture. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the coagulant. Usually it was rennet,
right,
but that becomes a problem for some people, doesn't it?
Well, sometimes. So rennet is really a word that we use for a collection of enzymes that are essentially going to change the proteins and change it from milk to cheese.
But it usually comes from an animal stomach.
Right. So what we're doing with cheese making is sort of redoing the conditions that are inside of the animal stomach. But there are other sources of rennet. There are microbial sources, which are grown in labs, not using any animal products. And then there are also very traditional kinds of rennet that are used in Portugal and western Spain from cardoon thistles, which are actually made into a tea, create a very, very particularly flavored cheese that I happen to love but is not universally loved. So there are a number
of
different
kinds. But those could be okay for vegetarians and for people who are kosher.
Right, absolutely. And the sort of flip side of that is that, you know, animal rennet is a very natural byproduct of the dairying industry, and you're not creating another animal product by supporting, you know, animal rennet cheeses. So it's sort of all part of the same system.
What about cultures?
Cultures can be a number of different things, right? So they can be things, as Giannakoulis mentions, that are around, right? And that's sort of probably how many of the first cheeses sort of spring forth, right? So that we can get all kinds of things that are sort of ambient. But then most cheesemakers, and Giannakoulis jump in here for sure, but most cheesemakers also will add their own different kinds of cultures.
Well, there are wild yeasts all over the place. Are they important to cheesemaking, Giannakoulis?
They can be both important and a bane. So it depends on what's going on. And definitely, you just when you think you've got things figured out, something happens one season that throws a monkey wrench in it and challenges you.
Is it the culture that gives cheese its flavor?
It's a combination of the bacteria, the yeast, the molds, and then the composition of the milk. and then what the cheesemaker and the affineur, the person who is in charge of the aging, which is often the cheesemaker in a small artisan setting, what they do to nurture that throughout the process. It's definitely a commitment to make a good long-aged cheese.
Well, do they add salt? Do they add flavorings?
The salt is used, and it's for flavor, but it's also equally for the cessation of the fermentation process early in when you've reached the acid level that you desire, and for its preservation early on. It's integral for all cheeses, I would say. People who want to have low-salt cheese should, in my opinion, just maybe have a little less cheese and enjoy it at its peak. But other flavorings can be added and used, and I happen to be a fan of certain types of cheeses with added flavors. I'm not quite the cheese snob that maybe I should be. I like cheeses that have been smoked the natural way, and we use some ale in some of our cheeses from a local brewery. You kind of have fun with it, too.
Does all cheesemaking involve separating the curds and the whey?
Yes, I would say it does.
So how does that work?
In my opinion, is a concentrated product through that process. It doesn't have to be through bacterial acid development. It can be through lemon juice and processes like that, but it's still a separation of the liquid. Whereas if you take yogurt, which is also cultured with bacteria, to thicken it, unless it's drained in the Greek style, it's still all the milk you started with is still there at the end.
So yogurt is not a cheese?
Unless you drain it, and then you could call it a yogurt cheese.
Now, Sasha, it's obvious from any trip to even your average grocery store, let alone a store like Murray's, that there's a wide variety of cheeses. Do we know how many different varieties there are?
I don't think there's any possible way to know precisely how many different varieties there are, because every day there's a new cheese and mm-hmm. someone stops making another cheese. And we do put these into different families. I like to think of them in five different families, so it makes it easier to sort of understand the vast
and
variety.
And those five families?
Typically fresh or unaged. Bloomy rind, which means it has a sort of a white mold typically growing on the outside. A washed rind, which means that certain yeasts and bacteria are propagated by washing the outside of the rind. And then the biggest family, which is just pressed or firm and semi-firm cheeses, which includes things like cheddars and goudas and granas. And then, of course, blue cheese.
So what makes a cheddar different from a brie, for example?
Well, there are a number of different things. I think all cheese making is broken down into sort of three areas. First, raw materials. Second, the cheese making techniques and process. And third, the aging. And in, say, cheddar and brie, all of these things are different.
And then blue cheese, you have to incorporate something else to give us the blue?
Right. So for both a blue and a brie, you would add cultures at the very beginning of the process to the milk to cause those molds, the blue or the white, to grow later. But with a blue cheese, you want those molds to grow on the inside. So you'd actually pierce the cheese with a needle or a set of needles to introduce oxygen to the inside.
Janiklis, what creates the rind found on some cheeses?
Oh, that's during the aging process, if the outside of the cheese is left exposed to the air, you have the potential to develop what we call a natural rind. And depending upon the process that the affineur applies to that, you can develop different sorts of rinds. Some cheeses, as Sasha said, are what are called a washed rind, where it's purposefully washed with a light brine solution that includes some red bacteria that develop a sticky, smelly surface that makes for wonderful changes on the inside of the cheese. Other cheeses can be rubbed with oil, they can be rubbed with ales, they can be left completely alone or brushed, many different varieties of rind treatments. And most of them are still edible.
I was going to ask about that. I'm always afraid
to
eat some rinds.
They're mostly still edible, although some people advise not eating certain rind types that might have developed some changes that wouldn't be as healthy for you. But you get committed rind eaters. We'll often be at an event cutting rind off for samples and have people just standing there with their hands out wanting only the rind. So it's kind of definitely a preference. I always suggest when people, and Sasha, correct me here too, or what you guys advise, when they're first sampling a new cheese, to not try the rind first, because it will be the strongest portion of the cheese. But to start with the
interior. It's like the skin of the vegetable.
It is sort of like the skin of a vegetable. We have one here, that a cloth-bound cheddar. So I just do want to point out, just so that no one eats this one.
Now, Sasha, you brought a whole bunch of cheeses. And we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, I want to take calls from listeners, also read some of the things that people have been writing in to our show page at WNYC.org, a Twitter account. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Also, you can go to our Facebook and communicate with us. My guests on today's Please Explain Look at Cheese and Cheesemaking as part of our Food Friday series are Sasha Anderson, Director of Education at Murray's Cheese, and Janicles Caldwell, who's a cheesemaker and author of Mastering Artisan Cheesemaking, The Ultimate Guide for Home Scale and Market Producers. It is published by Chelsea Green. I don't know if that's a form of cheese or not, Chelsea Green, but it sounds like it could be. And we'll be back right after this. And we are back with today's Please Explain, look at cheese and cheese making with Janicles Caldwell, a cheesemaker at Folia Farm, author of Mastering Artisan Cheesemaking, which is published by Chelsea Green, and Sasha Anderson, Director of Education at Murray's Cheese. And Sasha, you just handed me a piece of cheese. It's a cheddar.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminds me that not all cheddars are alike.
Certainly
now,
not.
Now, why is one cheddar like this so much better than the thing I get at the supermarket and a big brick?
Oh, there are a number of answers. One is the milk, first of all. So the milk for this cheddar, which is Cabot Clothbound Cheddar, it's sort of joint venture between Cabot and Jasper Hill Farms, is that the milk for this comes from just one source. So it comes from just one family rather than being, you know, a number of different sources pulled together. Really high quality milk. The make process is particular, and then it's aged for a number of months in a 22,000 square foot aging facility in Greensboro, Vermont, where it's brushed and turned and really taken care of, and then comes to our caves as well here in downtown, in the West Village in Manhattan. So there are sort of a number of different things that come together to make this cheese taste really, really good.
Our number is 212-433-9692. We're going to take a couple of calls and also read some of your comments to our show page and to Twitter. And we are beginning with John from Bergen County. Hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Leonard. I have a couple of three-part question, really. Relative to one, I understand from people that the cheese doesn't keep more than a week to 10 days. One, is that correct? And after that, it loses its flavor. Two, what's the best way of storing cheese? Would it be in wax paper, as Mr. Jenkins recommends, some cheese primer? And three, can you grind Parmesan Reggiano and put in a freezer to keep the flavor, or should you only use cheese that's fresh and then you grate it as you use it?
Okay, well, let's begin with you, Janicles. How long, when do you start shipping out the cheese to keep it fresh?
Oh, well, was this question after it's been cut or once when it's...
Well, I guess he's asking after it's been cut.
Yeah, I'll probably let Sasha answer that the best, but I would say and she'll probably answer all of those with a little more expertise than I will, but the grated cheeses on a lot of anything with low moisture can be stored in the freezer, but you would want to try to vacuum the air out of there, or that's going to set the flavor off.
So put it in a freezer bag where you've gotten all of the air you can out of the freezer
bag. Yeah, and of course, ideally, you would want to eat it fresh, but it's better to preserve it somehow than have it go bad in your fridge.
Well, Sasha, Murray's has Cobs down below the store, mm-hmm. and you have different rooms with different cheeses in them, and each one of them has a different freshness time?
Right. Well, each of the cheeses and cheese families have a different amount of time that they'll sort of stay at their peak, and it depends a lot on moisture content, but there are a number of other factors. So that's great for whole wheels, but for most consumers, you're probably not buying whole wheels of cheese. So what we sort of say to people is, you know, when they ask us the best way to store cheese, we often say say the best way is not to store cheese, right? So we will store the cheese for you. No, rather to buy what you need, right? And let us essentially store the cheese for you.
Yeah, but you're not going to eat every piece of that cheese.
Right, of course. So
you hope your guests will
secondarily, right. So secondarily, you want to pay attention to moisture content. So something like Parmigiano Reggiano is going to stay fresh for a longer period of time than, say, burrata or mozzarella. And it's going to stay fresher in a whole piece rather than grated. So I would say grate as you need if it's at all possible.
But what about freezing the grated cheese?
Once it's grated, it's so dry and there's very little moisture. You don't want to freeze any cheeses that have a significant moisture content because the water actually becomes problematic when it's frozen. It interacts with the fats in a not particularly great way. But as for what you want to wrap it in, wax paper is fantastic. There is special cheese paper. You know, if you really want to go the full length there, then you can get special cheese paper. But anything that's sort of semi-permeable is really helpful. And then the number one sort of tip for storing cheese is to always store it in the bottom of your refrigerator away from the fan. So clear out those vegetables. You don't really need them. And just fill that drawer with cheese.
Now, could you just put them in sandwich bags?
Sandwich bags are fine, right? But they're, you know, you don't get a lot of air exchange there. So something like parchment paper or wax paper, if you find that it's drying out, you can then cover it in a sandwich bag or a plastic wrap.
Jen, Chris, does hardness of cheese correspond to the amount of time that it's aged?
Often, but not always, but usually.
Because a Parmigiano Reggiano is aged for a long time. Isn't Goudas aged for a long time?
Well, and a lot of that corresponds with the size of the wheel. The larger the wheels, the longer they not only have to age, but the longer they can age. You know, so with a Parmesan, you're talking about almost 60 pounds for a wheel, and big guys, they need to age a long time, and they can age. So, like, you could take a small wheel that you've made at home and have it dry out too much and be as dry as one of those cheeses, but with no flavor in a very short time. So it doesn't directly correspond, but often.
Julia from Tarrytown. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for the show. It's great. I need some advice on homemade mozzarella. I've been trying this, and I understand it's not the most advisable cheese to try to make as a beginner like I am. It's come out a couple of times all right, and the other times when it's failed, many of them, I think it's the milk. But my question is this: when it's turned out and I taste a piece after it's just made and it's delicious, one time I've stored it in a brine, which is part of the whey and a little bit of water, and another time, and always ice bath before I let it cool down about 10 minutes.
Right.
And the other time I took it out of the ice bath and put it in Saran, you know, wrapped it in plastic wrap real tight. And the next day when I've taken both of these out, when I cut it, the best way I can say the consistency is out of the refrigerator, it's like a melty, and not in a good way, like a very melted, it's oozing and it just,
right.
What's happening
well,
there?
I'm assuming you're making the quick mozzarella.
Well, I don't use the microwave.
No, so, but it only takes an hour or two to make, right?
Right, yes.
Right. Well, I'll just tell you a couple things really quick. This recipe can be the most successful, and it can be very, as you found out, unpredictable. It depends. Mozzarella's and any curd cheese that stretches counts on it getting to a perfect level of pH and acid, and then temperature in order for it to stretch. So these quick recipes count on a measurement of citric acid, usually, that's added to the milk. But if that's too much or too little for that milk, then it won't work. Then you add on top of that the brining. The brining will work only if there's the right mineral balance in the whey or water that you put the cheese in. Otherwise, the next day, it will start sliming and oozing and be soft. I'm not here to exactly pitch my book, but there's some good advice in there on being more successful with these cheeses and trying to understand why they work, how they work, and then so that it turns out well every time for you.
And you have recipes for a wide range of cheeses. We have posted your recipe for ricotta cheese on our show page at WNYC.org. Is that the easiest cheese to make at home?
Definitely. Any cheese where you use added acid. And the cheese that the lady is talking about, the quick mozzarella, is an added acid version of the real thing. But the real mozzarella takes about 6 hours to make and is much more along the lines of cheddar making in the process until you get to the stretching. But the brining of the cheese, usually people add calcium chloride to that brine to keep that sliming, softening from occurring. And a lot of recipe books that are meant for people starting out omit those directions, and they're doomed if they omit that. So
can I make cheddar at home?
Feel better.
Could I make cheddar at home?
Oh, absolutely.
So almost all the cheeses that I eat, I could make at home if I have enough good equipment, I assume.
And good milk.
You need, pardon?
I said, and good milk. Right?
So I have to know a farmer.
Good milk, the right equipment. It can be pretty simple. And then the right process and a desire to put yourself out there for some failures.
Now, Sasha, there seems to be a crunch and a nuttiness with hard-aged cheeses. What causes that?
There are a couple of things that can cause that crunchiness in cheeses. One of them is an amino acid called tyrosine, and that's typically what you're tasting in cheeses like Parmigiano-Reggiano. And the other thing can be essentially a lactic acid precipitate, calcium lactate, which you'll find in cheeses like cheddars and things like that.
Now, listeners have been writing in. One person says, what are the best cheeses for those people who are lactose intolerant?
Oh, all of them. Almost all of them, I should say.
Cheeses actually go through a process that eliminates the problems for people who are lactose intolerant?
Well, I certainly want to stress that I'm not a doctor. But of course, the whole sort of difference between cheese and milk is a lack of water, and sugar is water soluble. So in the cheese making process, the point is to get rid of the water and all the things that are water soluble, including lactose. So most aged cheeses are going to have a very minimal amount of that sugar.
Pavla, go ahead.
I want to add real quick that the sugar is the food for the bacteria. Mm-hmm. And so the longer the cheese ages, the more the bacteria finish off all of that. So you can just correlate. If it's a fresh cheese, there's still going to be lactose present. And if it's an aged cheese, it's likely long gone.
So more likely an aged cheese mm-hmm. is right for you if you're lactose mm-hmm. intolerant. A listener, Pavla, asked on our show page, is it possible to make fresh spreadable cream cheese at home?
Absolutely.
Is it a difficult operation?
No, it's one of the simplest. it's a matter of just adding more cream to a simple fromage blanc type recipe that sits overnight with some nice starter culture and a little bit of coagulant.
And I can get that starter culture anywhere?
More and more, you can pick them up. Sasha, do you guys sell some starter kits there at Murray's?
We do for mozzarella and ricotta. We don't have the cultures there, but you can find them in a lot of different places. There's a great place in run by Ricky Carroll that sells a lot of really cool cultures
yep.
and all kinds of fun places that you can find them.
Go on the internet and you can
yep.
find them
yep,
all.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, if you're...
And as with anything homemade, it's the comparison, even using store-purchased milk, your typical pasteurized, non-ultra-pasteurized milk, making your homemade cheeses will take it up a level of quality that's amazing.
And would you prefer organic milk over... Well, the organic milk is usually ultra-pasteurized. Doesn't
yeah,
that
right.
kill a lot of stuff?
Yeah, and it causes some changes in the proteins that make it really difficult to make cheese from them. So
yeah, pretty impossible.
Yeah.
If you're serving cheese, what temperature should they be served at? Should you take them out of the refrigerator a couple of hours before?
Yeah, that sounds great. I always like to have cheese at room temperature and find that the more warms up to room temperature, the more flavor that you can get from the cheese.
When you're having guests over, the tendency is to try to have a hard cheese, a medium hard cheese, and a soft cheese. Mm-hmm. But then there's always the fear that, oh, that blue cheese is just going to be too powerful for some people. So do we want to buy in the blandest cheeses?
Oh, no, absolutely not.
No.
Right. You do want to have a variety of textures and flavors. But I think that most people are actually quite adventurous when it comes to cheese. So certainly don't try to play it safe. Buy the things that you like. Because at the end of the day, if no one likes it, then, you know, you just end up with leftover cheese that you yourself can eat.
Giannicles, I opened by quoting G.K. Chesterton's remark that the poets have been mysteriously silent on the subject of cheese. Have they missed it? Have they missed the poetry in cheese?
There are actually some really lovely poems out there about cheese, but I'm on a mission to change the adjective cheesy into something good. So, you know, when you say it's cheesy, that's a big compliment. That's in my definition. So I think somehow the word cheese itself has just not been embraced as poetic, but that should change.
Well, Sasha, just one more thing. How can you tell if a cheese has gone bad? And if it has mold on it, should you throw it away or just cut off the mold?
Oh, absolutely. You shouldn't throw it. That's not sort of the litmus test for bad cheeses, certainly not mold. The litmus test for bad cheese is, do you not want to eat it, right? So typically our bodies are good about telling us that, you know, cheeses have gone bad because they'll smell like ammonia or they'll look slimy and not good. But no, like you can see this, we have a goat cheese right here that has a little blue mold growing on the outside of its white rind, and that's perfectly good. I can even tell you the name of that mold if you'd like. But no, you want to look for things that are, you know, too moist or smell like ammonia.
Now, why does mold form on cheese that we have stored away well?
Go ahead. It depends on the conditions that you've stored. So a lot of times the conditions in which you're storing cheese that are good for the cheese are also good for the mold. So, you know, things that are cool and moist and have good air circulation are oftentimes good for the mold. And for the same reasons that we like cheese, well, not for the same reasons that we like cheese, but but mold also likes to grow in cheese.
Now, just we have very little time, but a listener wants to know why he can't get goat cheddar from Oregon. From your part of the country anymore.
He can come visit us and try some.
You make goat cheddar. But do you ship it to New York stores?
Pardon?
Do you ship it to New York stores?
I think Murray's has a little bit of our cheese there right now.
Yeah, we do. We're squirreling it away. Indeed.
But is it hard to get goat cheddar nowadays?
Oh, I might say goat cheddar. We do carry one goat cheddar regularly, actually, from Quebec. But there are a number of different goat cheeses from all across the country.
My thanks to both of you for participating in today's Please Explain Look at Cheese and Cheese Making. Sasha Anderson is Director of Education at Murray's Cheese. And Janiclis Caldwell is a cheesemaker at Folia Farm, author of Mastering Artisan Cheesemaking. It's published by Chelsea Green. On Monday's show, BBC foreign correspondent Kim Gottes looks at Hillary Clinton's time as Secretary of State and how she went from being called a polarizing politician to a popular diplomat. And then playwright Amy Herzog and actors Maria Dizia and Greg Keller discuss their off-Broadway production of Belleville about a young American couple who moved to Paris. Sam Lipside discusses his new book of short stories called The Fun Parts, and Esquire editor Tyler Cabot on stem cells and how research into their potential has been guided by a series of happy accidents. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan's the executive producer. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. We had help today from Casey Dalrymple and Jessica Miller. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.